Well, this should be the beginning of the static week, and unfortunately it starts off with something which is very non-static.
It's a dynamical beginning.
Yes, yes. We'll slow down in the course of time. So this is work on motion, on the well-definedness of the motion of a compact relativistic elastic body. This is based on work, on joint work with Michael Wernick-Pichler from the University of Vienna. So let me first say a few words about this general topic of motion of bodies. It's remarkable how few results are known concerning, well, rigorous results anyway, for the motion of compact bodies. In the relativistic case, and in the presence of self-gravity, one might say that the one result which is known is basically a corollary to the existence and uniqueness theorem for the vacuum Einstein equations. If one thinks of the bodies as black holes, for example, and thinks of initial data black hole initial data, or what is called black hole initial data these days, then of course there is a local existence theorem for the motion of them just by virtue of the vacuum Einstein equations. So in the relativistic case and in the presence of self-gravity, this is the only result which at least I know. In the absence of gravity, and even in the non-relativistic theory, there is, as far as I know, only one result known, which amazingly was only proved a very short while ago, and which was published this year. And this is the result due to Hans Lindblad on the motion of a non-relativistic perfect fluid. In the case... maybe I should also say that as for the problem which I will be looking at in this talk, there is not really such a big difference between the non-relativistic case and the relativistic case. The reason being, of course, is that the characteristic cone of an elastic solid is determined not by the space-time structure, but by the properties of the elastic medium, and it's so one has a hyperbolic problem, irrespective whether one is in a Galilean space-time, if you like, or if one is in a relativistic space-time. So one might think that the non-relativistic problem is in the literature. Well, it's certainly known somehow, but even that result, at least as far as I know, cannot be found explicitly in the literature. The reason perhaps being that this is a subject which is treated which is called mechanics by people working, say, at technical universities, and maybe those people don't care so much about existence and uniqueness theorems. So that is as far as what is known, at least as far as I'm aware. Now, another question you might ask is, why look at elastic bodies? Well, elastic bodies have certainly not been the most popular matter model in relativity so far. The reason being probably that in astrophysics, the behavior of astrophysical objects is largely determined by the fluid model and not by elasticity, with some notable examples, of course, as in the crust of a neutron star and so on. So this will probably never be probably an industry in relativity of elastic solids. But still, there are at least, from an aesthetic and from a mathematical point of view, there are many things to recommend elastic bodies. One being, as maybe not so widely known, is that as a matter model, it is much more stable than a fluid. Fluids, of course, develop shock waves, whereas it is known, it has been known for a number of years, that at least under suitable restrictions, reasonable ones, realistic ones, on the property of the elastic materials, there are long-term stability theorems. So there are solutions, there are large class of solutions which do not develop shock waves and which exist for all time in the non-relativistic case. And these results are due to Sidaris. Another reason why I find elastic bodies interesting has to do with static solutions, static and stationary solutions, about which I will have nothing to say in this talk, although there are several things in this area which I'm looking at jointly with Bernd Schmidt. I should say this whole program somehow grew out, is part and grows out of a collaboration with Bernd Schmidt of the AEI. When one comes to static bodies, in the case of perfect fluids, of course, then there is still many interesting things to learn, as we will hear tomorrow in Mark Heinzel's talk. But as far as the geometrical properties of the of these configurations is concerned, there is little structure because it is known, or at least it is known under certain assumptions that these objects all have to be spherically symmetric. Clearly, a self-gravitating static perfect fluid should better be spherically symmetric. This is a theorem under some restrictions which one would still like to remove, but it's certainly believed that this is true completely generally. So there is no, so as far as static, at least self-gravitating configurations is concerned, there is no shape. There is no shape in hydrodynamics, because obviously because of the lack of shear stresses in an elastic material. So this is a second reason why I find these objects interesting. A third reason, of course, is that this is, I think, geometrically quite a beautiful theory. It's also an ancient field theory, much older than relativity, and of course, its geometric nature was apparent right from the beginning, because it's a theory, as we will see, basically a theory of maps between manifolds. However, if you look at the classic literature in the subject, you will find that this geometry is not so easy to dig out. There is a jargon in the field which is very strange from a relativist point of view. So part of the fun is to look, or rather glance, at the literature and then try to see what remains of it if formulated, if seen through the eyes of a relativist. Okay, well, we don't need this anymore, I think. So now to the setting. So what sort of a field theory is elasticity, at least in the relativistic context? Well, elasticity talks about maps from space-time into which we take to be a four-dimensional Lorentzian manifold, into a three-dimensional manifold, or a co-dimensional one manifold, which is called material manifold, and which we imagine to be just a subset of R3 with some B, we call it B, with smooth boundary DB. So the picture one should have of points in this manifold is they should be considered as somehow the abstract points of which the material medium is made. So if one takes the value of this map at a specific space-time point, then this assigns to the event corresponding to this space-time point a certain particle which happens to be there at the time.
the problem, F is not defined on points N, which are not the
Well, F
is not defined where there is no material.
Yeah. Yes, yes. We will then, well, for the time being, you might think of this material as being infinitely extended, or, yes, it will not be defined on all of M, typically.
May I ask a question? I mean, if you say that's theory of elasticity, can one say this is the only or the only reasonable theory of elasticity, or are there other material theories?
Well, there certainly are. So this is what corresponds to what would be called, well, the equations I will write down ultimately would be, in the classical case, be called equations governing a hyperelastic material. So these are, there is no thermodynamics, at least for the purpose of this talk. So it's these are ideal elastic bodies, and the equations can be derived from a variational principle. So this already means, so this in the, of a certain kind, and, yes. I mean, I wouldn't be able to say,
but it's part of thermodynamical theory. One could,
yes, one could embed it. One could certainly embed it into thermodynamical theory. There are certainly things which are not there, such as memory or certain times of elastic behavior, which go beyond the ideal. Yes, so locally we will write, there is a pointer. So we take capital X to be local coordinates on B, and small x mu to be local coordinates on spacetime, and then we have this function is then given by these three functions of Fourier variables. There is an important regularity condition on these maps, namely they should be in some sense precisely constant along inverse images of points in B, and these inverse images should form time-like lines, and these time-like lines are of course nothing but the flow lines of the material. So this means that there should be up to scale a unique solution to this equation. So this is the equation for a vector u mu, which we normalize according to this relation, and this u mu is the four velocity of the material, which is described by this map. So the basic object for us are the Fs and not the Us. There is a formulation, for example, in hydrodynamics, I will later mention that the theory of ideal hydrodynamics is, in a sense, a special case of this setting, but these maps F are not the basic objects in any standard formulation of hydrodynamics. In a standard formation of hydrodynamics, it's the field U mu which plays the basic role. But, of course, U mu, if you like, you can view these F A comma, of course, U mu will be a functional of F and its first derivative. It is this you could view the Fs as some sort of potentials for the U mu. But if you only have the field U mu, you are unable to talk about things like deformations and deviations from a natural state and things like that, which are basic in any classical theory of elasticity. There is a formulation of relativistic elasticity due to Carter and Quintana, which just does just that. It focuses on the U mu.
Coming back to Robert's question, what's the role of dB? Do you need these boundary points?
Well, I will later need it because I will be. Well, here I'm just explaining the local theory. But when I talk about a finite body, I will need to talk about conditions at its boundary, and then I will need it.
Yeah, but is M the dog, then also something with a boundary, or?
Yes. There will be the inverse image of delta B will be the boundary of will be the boundary of the manifold on which this F will be defined.
So
it's
wrong to think of F as some kind as like a submersion whose fibers are time-like curves or something
yes.
like this?
Yes, exactly. Given this setting, there is immediately a quantity, the particle number density, which one can define. On B, we have a three form as part of the basic structure, a volume form. Now, given that we can pull back the volume form on B under F, this gives us a three form on the manifold, on the spacetime manifold, which and this three form is, by the properties of F, orthogonal to U. Therefore, it has to be proportional to this three form here. And the proportionality factor is what defines N. And the assumption is that the Fs which we are considering should be such that N is positive everywhere. And this is the particle number density. Which, of course, again, could be written down explicitly in some complicated way in terms of the functional, in terms of the Fs. It's useful to realize that in this setting, the equation of continuity is not something which one has to add, but which follows from it. The reason being is because omega is a three-form on a three-manifold. It has d omega is zero, and therefore this is also true for, therefore d of the pullback of omega is zero. But this, that d of the pullback of omega is zero by virtue of this definition is nothing but the continuity equation. So, our equations of motion will be derived from a variational principle, which turns out to be very important for all what follows. Of course, as I said in response to Gernot's question, in terms of non-relativistic continuum mechanics, this is already a restriction, maybe on the material even. So the materials which I will be introducing here, or rather the Lagrangians which I will be introducing here, correspond to materials which are called hyperelastic and materially frame indifferent. So this word materially frame indifference is a phrase which you read all the time if you look at the literature. What it means for us is basically diffeomorphism invariance of the Lagrangian. It amounts to this and nothing else.
Is this paper such a material?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I hope. Well, certainly if one adds enough variables. So there is an action principle with a Lagrangian density which will depend on F and its first derivatives and on X. And the assumption, so rho is the Lagrangian density, but it also in the theory plays another role. It's not only the Lagrangian density, but it's also the energy density of the material in its own rest frame, as it turns out. So in a relativistic theory, it also has a rest energy contribution. And the dependence on F and dF is assumed to be quite special, namely it is allowed to depend arbitrarily on F, but on the derivatives only via this object HAB here. So this object HAB is something which vaguely corresponds to strain, and it's not difficult to show that this assumption follows if one requires the theory to be diffeomorphism invariant. If rho only depends on f in its first derivative and wants to be diffeomorphism invariant, the only way it can depend on it is via HAP. Of course, many of the field theories which have nothing to do with elasticity, which we know, are of this nature, such as the scalar field or sigma models, and so on. They are all of this type. But of course, a theory of elasticity is singled out by the fact that it goes from a spacetime into a manifold of codimension one, and it has this regularity condition. This is what makes some nonlinear field theory of maps to a theory of elasticity, basically. So then we have the equations of motion, which are the Euler-Lagrange equations corresponding to this Lagrangian, and as it turns out, they are equivalent under these conditions to the divergence to a certain energy momentum tensor to be divergence free. This energy momentum tensor is the object written here. It is symmetric. It is under these conditions also the canonical energy momentum tensor. So, well, the canonical energy momentum tensor has one index down and one index up. If one raises the upstairs index, one obtains this tensor, which is symmetric, which is not true as you probably know for any theory, but for these theories it's true that the metric energy that this is also the metric energy momentum tensor, which one obtains from varying with respect to the metric, that they both are the same. So there is this term here, so rho u mu nu, which we know from a perfect fluid, and then there is the stress tensor, which is orthogonal to u mu, and which has this form. So if one divides rho by n, so then one obtains an object which is the energy density in the rest system per particle, if you like. In the non-relativistic theory, this is called, without the rest mass, the rest energy term, this is called stored energy function. So this is a function purely of HAB. If one takes the derivative of this with respect to HAB, multiplies by n, and then basically pulls back by f, one obtains this object, and that is the stress. This is the Cauchy, or rather the negative of the Cauchy stress tensor of the classical theory.
One denoted as Hooke's law of your reference.
Pardon?
Is that Hooke's law?
Well, Hooke's law is
linearization, of course.
Yes. Well, we have. Well, this comes in when we make. This comes in when we make some constitutive assumptions on rho, which I will come to.
But in principle, it contains.
Yes. Okay. So we want this. We want our configurations to correspond to a body, to an elastic body, moving on spacetime, subject to no other forces, and with a free boundary. So we have to impose conditions corresponding to this free boundary, and the conditions we are imposing are these ones. So we have the boundary of the spacetime manifold, which is formed by the inverse image of the boundary of the material manifold, and this has a normal and mu, and we require that T mu nu and nu should be zero. This is what we require. It's interesting that if we were to couple this theory to gravity, then in fact there would be no choice but to impose this. There would be no choice because, because of if we require the spacetime metric to be C1 across this at this time-like boundary, then by virtue of the constraint, there is, we are forced to assume. Of course, in the case of fluids, this corresponds to the condition of vanishing pressure on the boundary. I should have said that so far everything we are saying applies to perfect fluids if we assume that rho depends on HAB only via N. If rho is just a function of N, then we obtain by these formulae, we retain the equations of a perfect fluid. These things, I think, were recognized a long time ago, first presumably by Kiyovsky, as far as I remember. So, these are our boundary conditions. Again, if you look at the literature, you will find there are many boundary conditions which are used by people working in material science. These are called boundary conditions. This boundary condition, as we will see immediately, corresponds to the condition of vanishing normal stress at the boundary. These are a special case of people called traction boundary conditions, because normal stress is called traction in the business. People also consider what they call boundary condition of place, where this, as it will turn out, is basically a type of Neumann-type boundary condition. People also look at Dirichlet-type conditions. So if we did that in general relativity, so somehow in general relativity, these are not allowed, interestingly. We are forced into these boundary conditions. So if we then see what these boundary conditions say in terms of this energy momentum tensor, they say two things. They say that U mu has to be zero at the boundary. Well, this is not a further condition. This just follows from the fact that the boundary is an inverse image of points in B. So this is automatic. But the other condition is the interesting one. And by virtue of this formula, this condition says that the stress in this that the stress tensor has vanishing components normal to the surface. Okay, so so those are, as far as the general setting goes, now we have to look at the concrete situation and what can be said in terms of existence and uniqueness theorems. We will look at it now at a very special case. Maybe I can say, since my time runs so quickly, I should just say that there is no intrinsic it is certainly possible to consider much more general situations. So we will here confine ourselves to spacetimes which are sometimes called ultrastatic. So Minkowski space, of course, is a special case. So it's a spacetime which has the property that there is a time-like vector field in it, which is geodesic and curl-free. And we will assume that our elastic body is in a state which is close to a state we will assume that there is some sort of natural state. This is typical for elasticity. One talks about natural states and then states near that natural state. So the natural state will correspond to a relaxed material which is at rest relative to d by dt. Of course, it wouldn't do any harm, to identify both the spatial part of this manifold and B with identify them, and then perturb away from the identity metric. But conceptually, it's better to just not do it. So this time-independent map here is the map which we want to see as our natural configuration. So what is natural configuration? What does that mean? Well, first of all, there is a metric under these circumstances, GAB. Well, this is a contravariant thing, but supposing we have a covariant metric GAB on B, and we take the pullback of this metric under F0, then this should be GIJ. So we do not put a metric a priori on the three manifold B, but define it by the push forward, if you like, under F0 of GIJ. And then our conditions on the stored energy function epsilon is this, that when HAB, when the strain tensor is equal to this Riemannian metric on the material manifold, that should be some positive function which corresponds to the rest mass energy density in this configuration, and that the derivative of epsilon with respect to H at this GAB should be zero. This corresponding to the fact that this undeformed state has zero stress. So there is a state of zero strain, if you like, corresponding to HAB equals GAB, and that should have zero stress. And it also, well, it follows, it easily follows from this that this F0, if the Lagrangian satisfies this assumption, gives rise to a trivial solution of the equations of motion, which also satisfies trivially the boundary condition. And the question then is, if when we perturb these boundary conditions slightly, we still get a solution, and under which conditions?
I have a question about the fact that it's basically, if you have a very large body that's in its natural state, then you expect the interstitial space between any two particles to be smaller than if it's much smaller because of its own gravitation. So why, in both cases, should it be situation? That is, it should be compensated.
Yes. Well, first of all, there is no gravity in this. Of course, in the case of gravity, one can think of doing different things. One of the things which we did was to think of to look at solution at one parameter families of solution parameterized by the gravitational constant. And to imagine that if the gravitational constant is zero, then the thing is in its natural state, and then so this. But here there is no gravity. So now, well, now there are equations, there are boundary conditions, there are initial data close to some trivial initial data. And this is the problem we want to study. The obvious thing, the obvious difficulty lies in the fact that the boundary conditions that the boundary is free. The boundary is determined by being in the inverse image under F of the boundary delta B. So this is a free boundary value problem, and it's hard to see how this can be solved other than by changing to what is called the Lagrangian representation. So what we have been doing here corresponds in standard physicist terminology to the Eulerian picture. We now have to change to the Lagrangian picture. I think historically this is incorrect. I think both pictures, in fact, are due to Euler. So the what is called often the Lagrangian representation is called the material picture, the material representation by continuum mechanicists. So the way to deal with this is rather than look at maps going from M to B, look at maps going from R cross B into M. This is what it means changing to the material representation. It's important to realize that this is not like doing a coordinate transformation in a relativistic theory. It's something quite different, because we have a theory of maps, and what we basically do is we change the space by we make a transformation where each map is basically taken to its inverse. So this is certainly not a coordinate transformation. It's a very non-trivial kind of thing, and it's also difficult. It would be difficult to derive the equations in this picture by brute force. So what one does is to do this replacement in the Lagrangian. Then it turns out to be remarkably easy. So this is then what happens. So we replace FA of T of X by these things here, by XI, the spatial coordinates being functions phi I of T and XA. If we do that in the Lagrangian, then what we obtain is, well, the factor N basically cancels out. It becomes, because N from its definition is basically a determinant of of the first derivatives of F. So this cancels out by the transformation of the volume element. So what we find is a formula of this kind, where this gamma factor appears in this form here. And V squared is nothing but the time derivative of the inverse of this map phi. So this V is basically it's the velocity of these deformations in the material representation. And then what we have to do is to write down the equations of motion corresponding to this Lagrangian, and they are of this form, and then also to write down the boundary conditions. The important thing, and that was the reason for the exercise, is now the boundary becomes fixed. It's R cross dB. We now have conditions at a fixed boundary, and running through the equations, we see that this boundary condition is nothing but that this object here, dl by d phi I comma I, contracted with ni, so ni is the boundary of dB, in that should be zero. These are then our equations. So important, of course, are the coefficients of the leading order terms in these equations, namely this term here, which are the coefficients of the second time derivative, and this object, which corresponds to the condition or to the coefficients of the spatial derivative, and the conditions which we need. So there is a concept of hyperbolic system for such equations, which basically corresponds to this symmetric tensor to be negative definite with our conventions, and this to be positive definite in a suitable sense. There are different notions of positive definiteness for these objects, and there is a special one which we will need in order for our theorem to go through. So what we will need is, of course, the value of these coefficients in the natural state. This is all that is required. And in the natural state, it turns out that this is basically minus the spatial metric, space-time metric, and this object here is basically determined by the second derivatives of the stored energy function with respect to the strain HAB. So this is the object which is sometimes called elasticity tensor in standard elasticity. And we need some kind of positivity condition on this. As an example, in the theory of isotropic elastic solids, this object, this elasticity tensor LABCD, is just a combination of terms given by GAB, which of course in the standard theory is always taken to be the flat metric. And these constants, lambda and mu, are what is called the Lamé constant.
Probably, this L0, A, B, C, D, in the flat test, I seem to remember that this is essentially the Riemann curvature of the Riemann tensor.
Of what?
If you're doing elasticity theory in just flat space background, curvature tensor comes up. It's built out of the stress tensor.
So, the positivity condition, which we will require, will be the following. There is a weaker one, which is called strong ellipticity, which corresponds to the Legendre-Adamard condition used in the calculus of variations. This one is slightly stronger. So what we need is this kind of positivity condition that LABCD, which is symmetric both in AB and CD and also symmetric in the interchange of both pairs, should be a positive definite quadratic form in this sense. This is what we require. And it's easy to see that, for example, for an isotropic elastic material, this is the same as these two inequalities on the elastic constants, which are satisfied in many practical situations. It is then not difficult to show by using an argument which in the classical theory corresponds to the Korn inequality, that there holds this type this type of inequality holds for the spatial coefficients MABID, so that these things here are integrated over the material manifold plus the L2 form of delta phi is bounded below by the H1 norm of delta phi. This is called coercitivity, and it is implied by this condition, by these conditions on the elastic material. We can then sum up our equations in this form, by virtue of them being Euler-Lagrange equations, they are of this form. So there are these partial derivatives where alpha now is an index which runs from 0 to 3. So this is runs over t and the xa's basically equals something, and this equation is to be satisfied in the set in R cross B. And it's also easy to see that the boundary conditions are of this form, that F alpha I N alpha, for N alpha being the normal of this time-independent boundary, should be zero. So this is the nature of our equations. And then there are coefficients here, M alpha B beta I G, which of course comprise the MTT and the MABIG of before, and also the mixed ones, is of this form in our case. So in order for the theorem which one wants to apply to hold, what is required is this sort of symmetry condition of the coefficients M alpha beta ij, so that this is symmetric under simultaneous interchange of alpha beta and ij. And this of course is valid in this case. And then what is required is, well, again, that the 0-0 components are negative definite and that the MABIJ is coercive in that sense. Then also what we have to have is, we have now managed to get rid of the free boundary, but still in order for obtaining solutions with some prescribed smoothness, there will be corner conditions on the initial data, where the initial data surface intersects the boundary, in order for the solution to be suitably smooth. these corner conditions can be satisfied in this case, as it turns out. They can be one to arbitrary order in the derivative. So basically what turns out to be the case, that one can prescribe freely both the field phi and its time derivative on the boundary, and all their even order normal derivatives on the boundary. Whereas the odd order normal derivatives are all determined by this boundary condition and the free ones. So now we have transformed the problem in this form. Luckily, we are in a position to apply a completely general theorem due to Herbert Koch of 93, which says, I don't give the exact formulation in terms of function space and things, that there is a local solution, a local in time solution, which is unique, provided that the initial data for phi are sufficiently close to the initial data for the natural state. So this then is the theorem we were after, and that's it. Thanks.
Questions or comments?
Well, I'm a little confused about the natural state. I mean, how does that relate to the non-existence theorems for rigid bodies and so on?
Well, this one corresponds to a rigid body. Well, a rigid body in relativity. Well, first of all, well, a rigid body in relativity is. Well, that's a long story. Well, the spacetime which we had here was this one, minus dt squared plus gij of x, dxi, dxj. So the vector phi d by dt is, of course, a Killing. It's a Killing vector, it's geodesic, and it's irrotational. So therefore, it corresponds to rigid motion. But there is, of course, if we want to start from a natural state, and if we want this natural state to be stress-free, then from this machinery it follows that the field U mu corresponding to this natural state should be a bound rigid motion and also geodesic. So, I mean, and of course there are very few possibilities left. This has not directly to do with the problem of defining a rigid body in relativity, because this is as rigid in the non-relativistic theory as in the relativistic theory, because one requires it to be geodesic in addition to be born rigid.
Look at some old work by Trousdale, which he called hyperelastic.
Hyperelastic, yes. Well, this is, this here was hyperelastic. And then there is something different called hypoelastic. and there is work by yourself on hypoelastic materials in relativity. But this is different.
I thought we called them hyperelastic.
Well, you call them both, but in fact it's this. You use both names, but in fact it's this.
Inspired by classical work.
Yes, but these are different materials. These here are materials governed by stress-strain relationship. And here it's time derivative of stress, yes. Basically being related to, yes, time derivative of strain. So this is a different kind of materials. I couldn't.
You see appear the same constant eventually.
Yes, yes, but I mean the structure is quite different, and also. Yeah.